Perspectives not found in mainstream media. Time right now is 8 a.m. and the temperature outside is 21 degrees Celsius. Good morning, Mary Jane. Hello, are you there, Mary Jane? Hello? Hey, is anyone there?
Anna Marie Jensen is here.
Okay, so I think she just joined now.
Hello?
Hey, Mary Jane, here. We actually had just started the show already.
Okay, I'm on air now, right?
Yeah, I just read out my intro, maybe a couple
yes,
of moments.
Yes, I heard that. Just 1 second, John. I'll just switch phones. What I'm discovering is that my, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. My phone doesn't work. I use the portable phone works, but my regular phone doesn't work. I've dialed so many times that I couldn't get on. So thank goodness we've got that settled.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I was trying, I don't know, numerous times it wouldn't work, but it's the landline that doesn't seem to work. So at least I've got that situation straightened out. So I heard the theme song being played, and so I'm glad we're on air, and I'm just going to acknowledge that on Wooden Spoons, we are located on Treaty 1 territory, the traditional land and waters of the Cree, Ojibwe, Dakota, and Dene people, as well as the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis homeland. We also acknowledge the Shoal Lake No. 40 First Nation and its territory for our life-giving water. So this morning on Wooden Spoons, I just want to go over very quickly what our program will be consisting of. And, of course, we have an interview with our guest, Anna Marie Jensen, who I'm going to be introducing shortly for the first half of our program. And then for the second half of the program, I thought I would deal with address because of the importance of these issues, some peacemaking perspectives. And we will end with a recipe. And so I also want to make a statement that this is going to be our last program on Wooden Spoons for the summer. For the month of August, Wooden Spoons is going to be having episodes replayed while I'm on holidays. So that's just giving everybody the heads up that I will be sending in selections to be played on Wooden Spoons. And you'll be still there during August, John?
Well, I'll be available during August. Well, not all of August, but next week I won't be available. I'm also going away in a couple weeks after that as well. So, some weeks of August, but not others.
Okay. Yeah, so, and probably you, Ghana, will be looking after that part of the program. And anyway, that's just what I wanted to share with the listeners. And I would like to introduce our guest, Anna Marie Jensen. Are you there, Anna Marie?
I sure am.
Okay, well, we've been having a bit of a rocky start this morning, and now I figured out what my problem was. It was my landline. It doesn't seem to work for the PIN number. At least that's good to straighten out. So how are you this morning, Anna Marie?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Oh, good. Yeah. And so I just wanted to introduce you that you are the owner and operator of a business titled Reclaim Mending, and that at an early age you were encouraged by your grandmother, who gave you some thread and cards and shaped cards and a blunted needle, and you joined your grandmother doing mending. So Anna Marie's grandmother was her role model, and mentioning that Anna Marie used to live in BC and now she lives in the west end of Winnipeg. Anna Marie studied peace building and international development and became increasingly aware of the environmental and human rights violations of consumerism and the garment industry. Her interests and studies culminated in establishing a business titled Reclaim Mending. Anna Marie has always been interested in sewing garments and mending damaged ones. So today we'll be talking to Anna Marie about the many facets of her business and why it is important. It is an important contribution to offsetting the wastefulness and harm inflicted on our environment through our reliance on consumerism. So I met Anna Marie at the Farmers Market in Wolseley last year and invited her to join us on Wooden Spoons Men. So we're really honored to have you join us again this year, Anna Marie. So welcome to Wooden Spoons.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, so this year there have been a few changes made at the Farmers Market, and so they don't have too many craftspeople coming as they did before. That's the only difference I've noticed, and it's moved to from the Robert Steen Community Center to St. Margaret's Anglican Church, and so that's where it will be held while the Robert Steen is under construction. And the last I heard that the issues are very serious, and it may be several years before they get everything straightened out. There's a lot of plumbing issues and some very serious things that have to be done. So that's the situation with the farmers market. So getting back to you, Anna Marie, how did you start your business? I know that you, when you did start your business, you put a lot of thought and soul searching into it. So do you want to tell us about that and the ethical considerations that underpin your business?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you said, I started to learn to sew at a very young age. And clothing repairs were always a part of my understanding of how we care for and interact with our clothes. I also got involved in the fair fashion movement very young. I was probably 14 or 15. So the ethics piece has always been there for me. What really got me kind of more into it was when Lululemon, which was a Vancouver-based company, when they shifted from being manufactured in Vancouver to using sweatshop labor overseas. That was kind of a big thing that happened when I was in high school, and so that was kind of a big impetus for me getting involved in kind of the entire movement. And as for the business, the original idea for the business was actually a result of a conversation with some friends. We were talking about work and about our labor and, living in the world that we live in. And we were talking about what would we do if we could do anything for a job. And I said, I would fix people's clothes. And my friend Tony, he said, well, why don't you? I was like, oh, that's a pretty good point. And about a year later, I was burning out from my work with a nonprofit. And I thought I'd do a little bit of mending on the side. I had done it, throughout university. I had, mended friends' clothes and, that had always been a part of my life. And so I thought, well, maybe I can make a little bit of money doing this. It might bring me some joy. But then a few months later, I had to fully leave my job for my mental health. And my insurance wouldn't give me long-term disability. And so in some ways, that decision was made for me right there. And I started mending as my main income. So that was 8 years ago, and here I am, and I'm still going, I would say, busier than ever.
Well, that's an interesting story that you have, because, it was sort of cut out for you, but it sounds a bit, it was meant for you to be doing what you're doing. And so it was like fate intervened.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a very, it's nice that you have that perspective and that you sort of just flowed into another way of doing things, another type of career, without even, you know, without even just naturally doing it and following the cues that you received, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
So that is like a model, I believe, when people do things like that, and it's not in their plans, and suddenly they found their niche, so to speak. There's many facets to your business. I understand it entails sewing and darning and mending. When it comes to sewing, what things do you sew? And then also, while you're talking about that, could you explain the difference between darning and mending and why they are so important? And I think maybe perhaps a lot of people don't know what those terms mean.
Yeah, absolutely. So my main focus in my business is clothing and textile repairs. So essentially, if it's made out of fabric, I will try to fix it. So I've fixed not just, you know, typical clothing items, but, you know, like hammocks, rugs, bed sheets. Essentially, if it's made out of fabric, I'll give it a go. And mending is really just an overarching term for repairs. So it includes things like re-sewing torn seams, patching holes, and then also darning. And darning is a very specific type of mending in which you sort of rebuild the material rather than simply sewing a patch on top. So darning typically involves weaving inside of the hole or worn area of a garment in order to repair it. And darning is typically used on knit garments. So like sweaters or socks is the most common that, you know, people who are more familiar with it would think of as the darning socks. So yeah, they're kind of all just like subsections of each other.
Yeah, because darning is more for woolen materials and sweaters, as you say. And it's sort of like it's a weaving that goes on. So it's not like a patch. So
yeah, like it kind of is a patch, but you're kind of building the patch rather than slapping on a patch, right? It's hard to kind of describe with words, but they're quite different.
Mm-hmm. And it's a weaving. It's a bit of weaving that you do with woolen materials or that sort of thing for darning. So then when it comes to stitching or sewing by hand with a needle, there are many styles of stitching. And, you know, I'm familiar with the buttonhole stitch and the blanket stitch and just the straight stitching. But there are a lot more stitches that sewing pros can use. And maybe you'd like to share that with us.
Yeah, sure. So we use lots of different kinds of stitches for different things. So the stitch that you use to sew together a seam from the inside, for example, like on a shirt if the side seam has torn, or if you're doing essentially the same stitch, but you have to do it from the outside. So like when a parka rips, you know, that's very common that, you know, the shoulder or side seam of your parka rips. But in that case, you can't get at the seam from the inside. You have to do the repair from the outside. So those are different kinds of stitches, simply because you're coming at the project from a different place. Also, you know, there are stitches to make a hem invisible, or, you know, there are decorative stitches or more structural stitches. I kind of think about it like how there are different types of screws for different kinds of building projects, right? Like you have deck screws, you've got like the really long ones that you need if you're drilling something into, you know, the front of a house or something like that. It's kind of similar. Our screws, so to say, are these different stitches. And sometimes you need something different for a different job.
Okay. There was a stitch that I'd come across the name of. I can't remember what it was. Was it, an old woman's stitch or something like that? Is there any kind of weird, any colloquial words that people use for stitching?
Oh, I'm sure there are. I mean, lots of stitches have, like, the same stitch will have a few different names. I don't necessarily know what the old woman stitch is, but it sounds great.
Anyway, yeah, so it's, and you learned all these different stitches from your grandmother, maybe, or you just, how did you acquire the ability to do that?
Well, some of them I definitely learned from my grandmother. Some of them I, you know, learned as I went. Some of them I learned through books or, you know, come across a project and I'm like, maybe there's a better way to do this. And right, you look it up. And I have a huge collection of old sewing books, actually, that are very useful and very beautiful. And I like to have that history. So it's been quite a, like, hodgepodge of how I've learned things. I took one sewing class in high school, mostly for the grade booster, I think. I didn't necessarily learn a lot in the class, but I had fun. So I've kind of really hobbled together my skills just over time since, you know, I started more than 30 years ago. It's pretty easy to just acquire those, that knowledge over time.
You're listening to CKOW 95.9 FM. This is Wooden Spoons. My guest today is Anne-Marie Jansen, and our co-host is John Dick. John, perhaps you could give us the time and temperature at this point?
Yeah, for sure. The time is 8:17 a.m., and the temperature is 21 degrees Celsius.
Okay. Getting on to the our talking about stitches and so on. Years ago, I remember I had took some classes with a lady that was teaching hardanger, which is a Swedish type of handiwork and a very, very detailed. And everyone in the class were very experienced except me. And so I managed to lose a few stitches along the way, and it threw my whole design out of whack. And I had to alter the whole piece. It was one of those things. It was a small item that we were doing on some type of linen, and it required counting your stitches and so on. Mm-hmm. And I can't really describe how give you a good description of it. But anyway, I spent such a long time on that piece, mm-hmm. and I finally got it finished, and I still have it. So, you know, this has nothing to do with anything that is useful, but it is like an art form. So, do you have any? Would you have any commentary on sewing, or, you know, the work you're doing as an art form?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we could easily say that all textile work is art. As a society, we've really devalued some of that work, you know, a lot, because it's been feminized for most of history. So, you know, then feminized labor gets devalued. And, you know, now looking at how clothing is made, you know, we force people to work as operators. You know, they sew one single seam day in and day out instead of, you know, allowing people to be artisans. But I really think that clothing should be seen as art that we wear. And I love all the tradition of textile arts, like hardanger. And they exist all around the world. I mean, there's different styles of embroidery across the globe. There's different styles of textile dyeing and block printing. And it's just so incredible. I think you know, we as humans, we just love beautiful things and we love to make beautiful things. And I think that's so wonderful. And I just love all these traditions. And I think that they're important. I think they're culturally important. And I think that they connect us to our past. And yeah, I think that they're very valuable, regardless of if, you know, they're quote unquote useful or not. I think they're useful because they feed our souls. They, you know, connect us to our history. They help us teach future generations. And I think that it's really beautiful that people are kind of coming back to them in a lot of ways. You know, you see more and more people getting into doing, you know, cross stitches of various types or embroideries. And, you know, I think especially now in this world where, you know, we're kind of expected to be productive a lot of the time, I think it's really healthy for us to have something to do that is very mindful and it's very slow and it's very beautiful. I think that's really good for us.
You know, and it just, when you're speaking, it reminds me of the time when I used to, when I was going to high school, we had to board in town for a while. And my sister and I were living with a Ukrainian family. They used to be on the farm. And this woman, she had just an amazing repertoire of embroidery and stitching, all kinds of beautiful things that she made. It was really phenomenal. So I always remember that. I was starting to learn crocheting from her. But anyway, that it just I was just thinking how much effort she put into that. It was really amazing. At one time, you know, as you mentioned that it's not a dying art. I think, as you're saying, there are a lot of people that are doing it and maybe rediscovering it too. And I know that at one time people always mended their clothes, and the farm people could not afford to do otherwise. And I know my mother mended socks and repaired clothing on a sewing machine, and there was always clothing to be mended, like when people are living on the farm. And women often sewed their own clothes, and I know my mother sewed so many clothing. I don't even know who taught her. She used to make her own patterns and everything. I don't know how she got that skill. And they in those days, they actually used to make clothing out of flour bags, you know, and because you know, people were very poor. And then I knew my aunt, who was a great knitter, and she had a sheep, and she used to card her own wool. I guess people won't know what carding is, but you probably know, Anna Marie, what carding is.
Yes, I do.
And so, you know, you're pulling the wool together in these particular type of tools, and you get the wool cleaned and turned into from matted sheep's wool into a clean yarn. Anyway, would you want to comment on the skills of a bygone era?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, sewing and mending have been a normal part of the daily lives of most people since we started wearing clothes, really. A lot goes into making a garment. You've got to grow or raise the fiber, so like, you know, cotton or flax or, you know, raising sheep. You have to harvest the fibers, so whether that's picking or shearing sheep, that kind of thing. You have to spin the fibers to make them into a thread or a yarn. You have to weave them together or knit them. You have to design and pattern a garment, cut the fabric, sew the garment together, and even with modern industrialization, every garment that we have and wear contains hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of work from a wide array of people. Even the idea of cheap garments is really very recent, which is why it was normal for people even 50, 60 years ago to only have a few outfits, because clothing is valuable. And still, garments need to be seen as valuable and expensive. That has never changed. The process for making these garments, the whole process that I explained just a moment ago, it has barely changed at all. You know, some of those things are faster, for sure, but not even, you know, as much faster as people might imagine. What has really changed is who is paying for them. So, you know, back in the day, if you want to say it that way, but yeah, like you know, the individual or the household would be doing a lot of that labor themselves. Or if you were wealthy enough, you were paying directly for that level of labor. But now with fast fashion, the people who are really paying that price are the farmers, the factory workers, and the environment that is really taking on that cost. The only way for clothes to be as cheap as they are now is through rampant exploitation.
Mm-hmm. So do you want to comment on that a little more? I know that there are, you know, people employed by the garment industry that are having to do like menial, like repetitive jobs of the same thing all day long. But there's also, what about the waste that is caused by the garment industry? Is there, do you have any comment on that?
On the what, the waste side?
Yeah, like the waste that is caused by the garment industry.
Yeah, I mean, the garment industry consumes a lot of oil, not only for creating plastics, which, you know, a high percentage of our clothing is actually plastic, but also for transportation and, you know, operating factories, et cetera, like that. So there's a huge amount of, like, emissions and waste that happens on that level. So a lot, actually, the garment industry is the second highest polluting industry globally, second only to oil and gas. So that's, you know, that's pretty huge that is the case. Also, so then there's a lot of water waste, which also comes along with, as soon as you're using a lot of oil, there's a lot of water waste. But that also includes, you know, dyes and the treatment for various textile or fibers. And then, of course, there's waste in, you know, how the farms are forced to operate, or, you know, how the animals are forced to be treated. And then, of course, there's the very material waste that comes from a factory setting. And they do, you know, try to use as much, well, try. I mean, when cutting out garments, there's always going to be waste. And then, of course, at the rate at which garments are made, which is an unconsumable amount, right? Like, we cannot possibly use the amount of clothing that is being produced. So there is waste in what we call cutting floor waste, which is, you know, the scrap fabrics that just happen because they're being cut out. But then it's also the amount of just clothing, that fully made clothing that never gets sold, or, you know, people may buy and never wear and get thrown away, or get, you know, donated to thrift stores, but then get sent back overseas. So, I mean, you can see images of just these dumps in various parts of the world that it's just, like, you can't even imagine how huge these mountains of clothing waste are. And again, as I was saying before, each garment represents so much work. And so for that to be just tossed away is appalling. So, I mean, waste and the garment industry as it is go hand in hand.
I'm kind of surprised to learn that there's so many plastics in garments, and sort of like the synthetic types of fabrics, like jerseys, and I can't remember what they are, but they're easy to wear, and they don't have to be ironed or anything like that, as opposed to cotton. So, Yeah, that's phenomenal when you think about it. And then on the other side of the coin is people, what they do with their clothing today. How do you see that? Do you see when people are, when they don't want, when there's this, a hole in their sock or a hole in something, do they throw it out and or do they mend them?
I mean, I think the average person doesn't even necessarily know that things can be repaired. You know, again, I grew up with that being a very normal part of clothing, is you fix them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I get a lot of clients who bring me something and they're like, oh, is this repairable? Because it's never occurred to them that that could be done. Because how would they know, right? If they've not been taught, and maybe even their parent hadn't been taught that that's a normal thing that can be done, how are they supposed to know that, right? So there is definitely a lot of, you know, misunderstanding around what's possible there. And then also, because clothing is so cheap, it doesn't seem worth it to fix things, right? And again, like, because clothing is so cheap, people wouldn't even necessarily think to fix things until it's something that they're emotionally attached to. And that's something I think is very beautiful about humans, is we are sentimental. And, you know, I get a lot of people who bring me things that are like, oh, this is my favorite sweater, can you fix it? This is my favorite pair of jeans. This was my dad's jacket, like this kind of thing, you know, and that is kind of a really neat entryway into helping people see that all garments can be valuable. And that sentimentality is really what brings people to have things fixed. And I mean, a lot of people don't have the skills to do it themselves because they haven't been taught. So, I mean, that's why I'm here, right? Like, that's my purpose.
yeah. And so I can see that, because I know people that are much younger than me, and they don't know how to sew a stitch at all. It's just not something that they've been exposed to or taught, and I don't think it's being taught in schools, although I think at one time it might have been, but I don't think it's valued at all. And so when there's a hole in your sock, you throw it away, which is so not the, you know, so wasteful, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How about your own business and the services that you provide? And do you want to tell us about that? And who are the people that come to you for services?
So, I mean, my business is, again, like, repairing is the main thing. I also do alterations. So if something doesn't fit quite right, I can make that fit better. You know, hemming, that's the thing that people kind of think about immediately when they think about even repairs or alterations. They think hemming. So yes, I do hemming. I also make custom garments at request. And then I also actually make things to sell out of fabric scrap. So I use scraps actually often from other makers in the city. So I have, you know, this beautiful linen scraps from a different maker, or wool scraps from a different maker, and a lot of scrap jeans, actually. A lot of people bring me their old jeans that they, you know, they don't want anymore, but they can't be, like, resold or passed off to a thrift store because they're damaged. So I have the piles of denim that is still, there's still a lot of useful parts to it. And then I, you know, make other things out of it. So that's something that I really enjoy doing. I mean, I enjoy doing most of it, but I also give workshops and lessons. So, you know, kind of trying to bridge that gap of skills that has happened is an important part to me. And yeah, my business is doing great, busy as always. People can book appointments to drop off their mending or come for a fitting for alterations just on my website, reclaimmending.com. And Yeah, the kind of people who come to me, it varies greatly. Kind of all sorts. Again, that sentimental part is a big pull for a lot of people. And again, the like favorite pair of jeans, right? Anyone who wears jeans knows it's really hard to find that pair that you feel really good in, that fits really nice, they're really comfortable. And so once you find that pair, you want to get it fixed. And then, of course, because styles change so fast, there's no guarantee that you'll be able to get that same pair again. So that's a big draw, is just, people who wear jeans. The big entryway into my business.
Oh, so to get in touch with you, all people have to do is email you at info@reclaimmending, and reclaim is just spelled reclaim mending, mending dot com.
That's correct.
So that, and do you actually sew anything for people if they want you to actually make a garment? Do you do that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, custom garments
Okay.
are quite expensive, again, because they should be. And so for me to pay myself a living wage, that's how that needs to be. And but I love doing them. I think that it's really fun. I think it's really cool to see someone value a garment that much, right? That they're willing to pay what it costs to actually have a garment custom made. And yeah, it's a fun thing to do. I make some clothing for myself, though I have to say most of the time I'm actually just preparing or altering my own stuff. And yeah, I do quite a bit of that as well, but my main focus is repairs.
So you're obviously a very busy person.
Yes.
Well, that's wonderful, and I just would maybe you could just reiterate again the environmental and human rights violations of the garment industry. This is kind of something that we don't really think about it because it's not we don't see it, but I think we should be aware of that.
Yeah, I think that you touched on exactly why people don't think about it, is because it's not in our backyard. I mean, it is a little bit. There are, sweatshops in Canada. There's probably ones in Winnipeg, but they're quite hidden. They're quite underground in that way. And so and also, of course, we don't see that waste, right? Like I said, those piles of discarded garments, we don't see that. In the same way that people do it in other countries. And I mean, the environmental and human rights violations of the garment industry, that could be a several hour lecture. The thing about the garment industry is that it hits pretty well every global issue. So if you can think about a global issue, the garment industry is involved or has that aspect, right? So we've got, oil use conflict as a result of oil use, climate change, pollution, women's rights, children's rights, workers' rights, animal rights. It's such a global industry and it touches on everything. So
How
yeah,
about
it's that.
animal rights? How does animal rights fit into the gar abuse?
I mean, it really, the leather being a huge industry is leather, and so the treatment of the animals involved in the leather industry, even in like wide scale wool production, there can be some violations there. And then, of course, also, I mean, as soon as something is so environmental impacting as the garment industry is, it's ruining ecosystems entirely, right? And so that is violating animal rights as well.
And we should always be concerned about animal rights, and I am appalled at our lack of legislation to protect animals from cruelty. Anyway, that's a whole other topic. But so do you? I think your type of work that you're doing is an inspiration to others, and I'm sure that you are influencing others that want to replicate what you're doing by doing their own mending and things like that. Mm. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely something that I want to do. I love teaching people how to mend. I love empowering people to care about their clothes and to think about these issues and the impact that we have through our garments. I think it's really important. I think, you know, we have to make those changes ourselves. I mean, in order to solve a lot of these problems, we essentially have to dismantle the entire fast fashion industry. And so that requires us to, you know, hearken back to our ancestors, and again, not very long ago ancestors, to take care of our garments and to respect them, respect the whole process that goes into making them. And that's a big part of why I do what I do and what I like to, you know, encourage people to remember.
And so if the people want to find out about any classes that you offer, they can just contact you from your email address, right?
Yeah, and I'm actually teaching some workshops at the Take Root Festival in a couple of weeks. So people can go to takerootfest.ca, and you can, there's a whole bunch of different sort of related.
What festival did you say?
Take Root. It used to be the DIY Homesteader Fest, and now it's called Take Root. And so they have lots of different workshops that are, you know, based on this kind of thing. There's like canning, there's, you know, how to spin wool, there's how to dye textiles, and I'll be doing drop-in mending and darning kind of thing. So, but yeah, you can check on my website for any other listed workshops coming up, or if people are interested in lessons, you can contact me, and I'm happy to make that work with someone.
Okay. And your website is?
Is reclaimmending.com.
Okay. So that's a good place to visit. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Anne-Marie, for joining us this morning. You certainly gave us a lot to think about and to be aware about, and I really appreciate what you're doing. And again, thank you. For joining us this morning on Wooden Spoons.
Thank you so much, Mary Jane.
Okay, so I guess at this point, if we just make a note, this is Wooden Spoons. My name is Mary Jane Eason. We were talking to Anne-Marie Jansen, and with John Dick as co-host. And John, could we have a song at this point in time?
Yes, I am going to put on A Coat of Many Colors by Dolly Parton.
That sounds like a good selection.
I haven't put it on quite yet.
Oh, okay.
Back through the years, I go wandering once again. Back to the seasons of my youth. I recall a box of rags that someone gave us, and how my mama put the rags to use. There were rags of many colors, but every piece was small, and I didn't have a coat, and it was away down in the fall. Mama sewed the rags together, so in every piece with love, she made my coat of many colors that I was so proud of. As she sewed, she told a story from the Bible she had read about a coat of many colors Joseph wore, and then she said, perhaps this coat will bring you good luck and happiness. And I just couldn't wait to wear it, and Mama blessed it with a kiss. my coat of many colors that my mama made for me. Made only from rags, but I wore it so proudly. Although we had no money, well, I was rich as I could be. In my coat of many colors, my mama made for me. So with patches on my breeches and holes in both my shoes, in my coat of many colors, I hurried off to school just to find the others laughing and making fun of me. In my coat of many colors, my mama made for me. And oh, I couldn't understand it, for I felt I was rich. And I told them all the love my mama sewed in every stitch. And I told them all the story mama told me while she sewed, and how my coat of many colors was worth more than all their clothes. But they didn't understand it, and I tried to make them see that one is only poor, only if they choose to be. Now I know we had no money, but I was rich as I could be. In my coat of many colors, my mama made for me. Made just for me.
Could we have a time and temperature again, John?
Yeah, time is 8:46 a.m. Temperature is 21 degrees Celsius.
We're going to be moving along to the next segment of Wooden Spoons, and just want to point out that Harold Schuster will be back in September, or maybe a little bit later. We had a monthly discussion about the Middle East crisis with the Palestinians and Israelis, and I wanted to share some peacemaking thoughts and concepts. One of them comes from Rabbi from the Shalom Center, and I think his name is Rabbi. Oh, I just forget his name. Anyway, the statement comes from the Shalom Center, and there is a commentary that there's a new coalition of advocacy groups. Some of them Jewish-led, are urging lawmakers to amplify the voices of those in Israel, Palestine, and around the world who reject Netanyahu's failed leadership. Pressure is mounting on the United States lawmakers to skip Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's scheduled address to Congress that happened this week, actually, as a newly formed coalition of civil society groups announced at a protest against the far-right leader whose policies and actions in Gaza are on trial for genocide at the World Court. This is by Rabbi Schachter. As Netanyahu brings to Congress his message of extending and expanding the devastating war in Gaza, neglecting the safety of Israeli hostages, and ensuring impunity for the actions of his government, an alternative message must be heard. The new coalition said in a statement Monday, to amplify a message of safety, freedom, just peace, collective liberation, and human rights for all Palestinians and Israelis, 9 diverse groups have come together to form the Peace and Justice Protest Bloc. The groups are American Friends of Combatants for Peace, Win Without War, another word, TRUA, TRUAH, Sisterhood of Salaam, Shalom. Sisterhood of Salaam, Shalom. Israelis for Peace, Halakhic Left, and 3 local chapters of supporters of Standing Together will come together in Washington this week to urge members of Congress to skip Netanyahu's speech, so they would have done this already, and to sponsor community events with peace activists from the region and amplify the voices of those in Israel, Palestine, and around the world who reject Netanyahu's failed leadership. The bloc, made up of hundreds of Israeli, Palestinians, Arabs, Jews, and allies, will unite. They would have already united to demonstrate the collective struggle and liberation that the collective struggle and liberation are possible. And there is a growing movement that embodies it, the coalition added. We must act now to ensure that the voices for a just peace are louder than those of division and bloodshed. Numerous congressional Democrats have already said they will not attend the address, as has independent U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who on Monday reaffirmed that he will skip this speech. Netanyahu and his right-wing extremist government have waged total war against the Palestinian people, killing at least 39,000 Palestinians and injuring 89,000, 60% of whom are women, children, or elderly people. Sanders said Netanyahu should not be welcomed into the United States Congress. On the contrary, his policies in Gaza and the West Bank and his refusal to support a two-state solution should be roundly condemned, the senator said. Axios Capitol Hill reporter Julie Grace Brookby, or I'm not sure how to pronounce it, said Monday that Vice President Kamala Harris has declined to preside over Netanyahu's speech, as is her prerogative as Senate President. So has Senate President pro tempore Perry Murray from D. Washington, leaving uncertainty who will be presiding over the session, which has already happened, of course. But I just wanted to point this out, that there is no shame in standing up for peace. And I am so grateful that there are many Palestinians and many Jewish people that are recognizing that there needs to be a peaceful solution. And Rabbi Arthur Schachter, he's very active in promoting peace. The Shalom Center is located in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I had attended his workshops way back when Alon Weinberg was organizing events with Rabbi Schachter. He's a wonderful teacher and speaker and peacemaker. On a more strident level, about peace, a counterpunch is much more strident in their rhetoric, and when the media serves as an ideological state apparatus to genocide, this is written by Gerald Sussman, and he said, since attaining statehood, Israel has been a de facto protectorate of the Zionist wing of American ruling elites. From 1946 to 2023, Israel was by far the largest recipient of U.S. aid, $300 billion, with virtually all of its military assistance spent in the U.S. serving the buildup of the military-industrial complex and financed by what is now in total $1 trillion in government annual military outlays. This form and of assistance and massive subsidy to Israel is part of an international money laundering scheme by which taxpayers are bilked of huge money transfers to private corporations. Another article is the apartheid. I'm leaving out some of the words here. The Scourging of Gaza, Diary of a Genocidal War by Jeffrey Clare. This is all from the Counterpunch website. The International Court of Justice has made definitive what has been obvious for decades. It's about the apartheid. In a sweeping ruling announced on Friday at The Hague, the court ruled that Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territory violates international law and should be ended. It determined that the occupation amounts to annexation of Palestinian lands and that all Israeli settlements should be evacuated and land returned to Palestinians. It is said that all Palestinians have been forced into exile, that all Palestinians who have been forced into exile should be granted the right to return, and that Israel must pay them reparations for its destructive actions. The court described Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the occupied territories as a form of racial segregation and apartheid. and call for the dismantling of the apartheid wall, checkpoints, and other barriers to travel. So there is a lot of reaction in the world, and it's very hopeful that there are people from all sectors, from all religious backgrounds and so on, include Israeli and Palestinians together, that are supporting peace. And we must be thinking in peaceful terms to end this horrible war that is happening, and the destruction of the Palestinians' land and what's happening there. I wanted to share that because it is a message that needs to be spoken openly, without fear, with confidence, and with trust in a higher power, in the power of peace. On this note, I'm going to end with the recipe, as we're running low. We're getting close to the end of Wooden Spoons. We will be returning in September, and during August, we will have replays selected for Wooden Spoons. And I don't have any particular recipe, but this is the time where we get all these garden, market garden produce, and it's wonderful eating the food. There's such a different flavor in the food that you buy. So I cooked a bunch of beets. I took the tops off and cooked the beets themselves in boiling water until they were tender, and then peeled them. And a good way of preparing beets, and it's always delicious, is just cutting them up in cubes and then warming them up and adding salt and vinegar. And you could add butter. And they're very tasty that way. Another thing that is very easy to make are using beet tops, or Swiss chard. Swiss chard is very available in the farmers markets right now. Everybody's collecting their chard, and so beet tops and chards are very good for making greens, stir-fried greens. So what you do, you cut up the Swiss chard in small pieces, slice it, and the leaves as well, and you can do the same thing to beet tops. You can do the same thing to radish tops as well, also. So what the easy way to do it, this is how I do it, is a simple way of cooking. You heat up a frying pan with a little bit of oil, and you can add some onion and garlic, finely chopped. And then you add your chopped up beets and so on, chopped up beet greens or charred greens. And sometimes the stems are very colorful, depending on the type of chard you get. And so you cook that until they are tender, and you stir constantly. Add a bit of oregano or some herbs that you prefer to use. And that's a very simple way of making a very delicious vegetable, and it's easy to do. And right now it's very available. So I encourage everybody to go to the farmers markets. Just buying a tomato from the farmers markets, one can tell the difference between the store-bought tomatoes and the ones you buy at the farmers markets. I got a response about how the flavor was so good from the tomatoes I bought from the farmers market. And so that's not me saying it, is somebody else that tasted it, that who's my husband. So if this is a wonderful opportunity to support the farmers markets when they come into your community. I know in the Wolseley we have it set up at the St. Margaret's Anglican Church. It's quite compacted in there, but it's working out very well. And it's really an opportunity to meet people and also to see all the other booths that are there, and there's wonderful breads that are being made. And we had interviewed one of the people at the farmers market a few weeks ago, Chris Hallbrook, and they make wonderful breads. And I will be interviewing his partner, who is behind the bread making and the cultivating the wild yeasts that go into the bread at some later dates. So at this point, I just want to thank everybody for listening to Wooden Spoons. I'd like to thank our guest, Anna Marie Jansen, and thank you, John, for being